goodness gracious. God. Well, you got your tissues, you got, all right. You want a tissue? You got, all right. Okay, and now it is also with great pleasure that I present to you our AA speaker, Bill B. from Little River, South Carolina.
Thank you. You
are home. I love you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Bill, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Bill.
And I'm sober this morning through the grace of God, the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and an awful lot of people who taught me how to stay away from one drink one day at a time, and for that I'll be forever grateful. Back home in South Carolina, as you can see, I got a southern accent. Actually, it's South Brooklyn. But we mentioned our sobriety date, which was April 8th, 1962, and for that I'll also be very, very grateful. Like Bernadette, I would like to thank everyone who has been so kind to us, really, really kind, and welcoming. What a wonderful, wonderful convention. And I want to thank the committee, and I'm glad Bernadette has not got into the basket yet, because after tomorrow I can start eating candy again, and there'll be some left. I want to thank the speakers for their wonderful words, especially Beverly, because Beverly, like Bernadette, helps remind me of what this disease does to families. This is a family disease. And for a long time, as I began to sober up, I didn't want to think much about that. I knew I hurt my family. I knew I hurt Bernadette. But now I was going to make up for it and everything would be okay, you know? And it wasn't until I heard Bernadette speak for the first time at an Al-Anon group anniversary in Yonkers, New York, when she told her story and I felt her pain, I had difficulty handling it at that point. And when Beverly speaks and talks about how this disease is really, really hurts the family, I think all alcoholics need to be reminded of that. I really do. And I know I do. So I thank both of them. I also want to thank our hosts, the hosts with the most. They really are, Karen and Scott. They've been absolutely terrific for us, really. Just wonderful, wonderful people. Not only did Karen pick us up at the airport, but then we got to the hotel. And then Scott's been shoveling us back and forth to church for our Easter services. And I'm so grateful. I don't think you realize how grateful I am. You see, alcoholism took my religion away from me. Now, Alcoholics Anonymous is not a religious program. We all know that. But I had spent 4 years in a seminary studying to be a priest, believe it or not. Berna started to be a nun, and I just couldn't wait to get into her habit. I guess that's why I left. I guess that's why I left the seminary. I don't know, through sobriety and the grace of God, I have gotten back into my Catholic religion, and I'm very, very happy. It supports my sobriety, my spirituality, and it's just wonderful. God has been so good to me in that way. I found my God in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had been searching for him in my church. Strangely enough, I couldn't find him there. What I found was a guy who was always angry with me. I found an old man sitting on a throne in the sky with a big red book writing my name in it in red ink, you know. I'm going to get him for that one, that's for sure. You know, that kind of... But I just never... You know, I could never find a loving, forgiving God until in Alcoholics Anonymous I met a Jewish jeweler from Brooklyn who became my sponsor, Benny Michelson. And Benny Michelson had a loving, forgiving God in his life, and he shared him with me. And through that God, I have found my way back into my faith. And I love my faith, and that's why I get... Anyway, I'll stop there. I'm not going to get even with Bernadette, you know. No, this, No, I've tried that too many times, and it's like having a relapse. Although Bernadette had a relapse yesterday. She really did. She had an Al-Anon slip. She was very nice to me. So anyway, thank you, Bernadette, for sharing all those goodies. And she talks about having all those children. And then she says, I wasn't around much. What the hell? I mean, I didn't mail it in, you know. Jeez. And anyway, we had five children. That means we made up five times. And then we had four more when I sobered up, because a lot of things begin to work again when you sober up, you know. So that's how all that happened. That puts that at rest. And then she always forgets to mention, and she always reminds me, you got to mention that we have 23 grandchildren. That's because we got a bunch of horny damn kids. That's why, you know. And what? Oh, and one great grandchild. Are we that old? For Christ's sakes, really? Oh, geez, I didn't know that. Anyway, I want to now share with you my experience, strength, and hope, what it was like, what it used to be, what has happened, what it's like now. I remember my sponsor telling me one of the first times I was asked to speak at a meeting. He said to me, the reason we ask you to speak at an AA meeting is so when you get up there, we can all sit there and take your inventory, you know. And that's what I used to do. You know, I would listen to a speaker and eye him or her, and, you know. And I knew all about them before they opened their mouth, you know. But you don't have to take my inventory. I got somebody that does it all the time, so you don't have to take my inventory. I can best describe my life as being, like so many of us, a young man who was given so many opportunities, who was given so many blessings, so many chances, and who drank it all away. I drank away everything that was near and dear to me in my life. That was more, whatever it was, another drink was more important. Now, if you had told me that, I would have gotten angry, or I would have laughed or something, you know, because I wouldn't have not understood that. But it was only by coming to Alcoholics Anonymous and listening to you and you sharing with me and having a wonderful sponsor, getting into the book, really studying the book, which is still a very, very essential part of my sobriety, did I come to understand that. I came to understand that my disease doesn't come out of the bottle. You know, my disease is in me. The bottle brought it out. I came to understand that drinking was only the symptom, and that all of my character defects and shortcomings was my disease. And that's why I'm still here, because I'm still working on my disease. And if I don't, I'm a very unhappy man, but when I do, I'm usually a very, very happy guy. Now, I didn't understand anything about alcoholism, even though I grew up, unlike my lovely wife, in a home and in a family that was riddled with alcoholism. I mean, it was riddled with alcoholism. My father, she mentioned my dad, he was an alcoholic. Okay, four of his five brothers died of this disease of alcoholism. You know, my grandfather, Archibald McClintock, was an alcoholic. I always say, with a name like Archibald McClintock, hell, you got to be an alcoholic, you know. And his wife, my grandmother, Lizzie Grant, was an alcoholic. My uncle Ken, I can go on and on, both sides. But, you know, I never heard anybody in my family ever call anybody in the family an alcoholic. They only reserve that for the Bowery derelict. So I didn't know anything. I didn't know they were alcoholics. I only knew as we were driving in a car and we would see a guy sitting on a curb picking lint out of his navel, it is an alcoholic. Okay? But the fact that we had to take Uncle Willie to the hospital one Sunday morning, I was 12 years old at the time, I never will forget it. He was as yellow as my shirt and tie, and he had something under his coat I thought was carrying a football. It was his liver. And he died 4 days later of cirrhosis. And those were the, and all people said was, poor Uncle Willie, and that's the way it was in my family. So anyway, When I was 13 years old, I went away to the seminary, and I thought, now when I look back at it, I guess I wanted to get out of the house. Because, you know, Beverly was sharing what goes on in an alcoholic home and what went on in our home. And it went on in my mom and dad's home, yelling and anger. I mean, my father was a raving alcoholic. My mother was a raving, untreated Al-Anon, you know. She was always very angry. But she couldn't help it. She didn't know how to handle this thing that she didn't understand, you know. So yeah, I went away to the seminary. I was going to be a Marian old missionary priest. I was going to go to China and save all the Chinese. Now, why I picked on a Chinese, I don't know. And in a seminary, you had to do, in addition to studying, you know, and all, you had to do chores, manual labor, because that's what you had to do as a missionary. You know, I always... The reason I wound up there, by the way, is I read a book. The Sister Superior in our Catholic grammar school gave me a book about a Maryland missionary priest who had been captured by bandits and who had been executed. Now, I love hero stories, and that was a hero story. I said, what a way to go, man, you know. So I decided I was going to be... I had a spiritual director at the seminary who was very narrow-minded. You know, he watched you pretty closely. So after 4 years, he came to me one day and he said, William, I don't think you're quite cut out for the seminary. And he mentioned some silly little thing like I had volunteered to paint the nuns' convent and I spent 4 days on a ladder next to their bathroom. And he, you know, so it wasn't an accusatory kind of thing, you know, but he thought maybe I leaned in another direction. Remember, he said to me, Bill, I think one of these days you might make a wonderful father, but not in this place. So I left. So I came out into the world. Now, like I've heard so many of you share with me about how you were like, even before drinking. And that's the way I was. When I was a kid, I was a very uptight. I was shy, yet I wanted attention. I was always fearful of things, you know. I was never comfortable in my own skin. Never. And now I come out of a seminary, having been away from the boys in the neighborhood and the girls and all. I came home, I was 18 years old, and I was really uptight. I got a job working for a New York City newspaper as a copy boy. I was finishing up my education at St. John's University in New York. I uncovered a story. And as a result of that, they made me a newspaper reporter. I was 18 and a half years old, wet behind the ears, scared to death. And they said to me, the city editor called me over to the desk and he said, kid, you got a nose for news, we're making you a reporter, and you're going to be on the lobster shift over in Brooklyn Police Headquarters. So I said, fine, what do I do? He said, go over to Brooklyn and the other reporters will break in. Just ask them what they do and they'll tell you just what they do and so forth and so on. Anyway, so I go over to Brooklyn and I walked up to the lieutenant on the desk and I said, where can I, by the way, there was 18 newspapers in the city of New York back then, 18. It was in the mid-50s, and it was a heyday of journalism in New York, and it was what a wonderful opportunity I had, because the paper I went to work for was the largest evening newspaper in the world at that time. It was the Hearst flagship paper. So I go over to Brooklyn, and I said to the lieutenant, where can I find some of the reporters? I want to talk to them. And he pointed across Flatbush Avenue in Brooklyn, big thoroughfare, to the Edison Bar and Grill on the corner. And he said, go over there, you'll find some of them in there. He was wrong. I found all the reporters in the Edison Bar and Grill. And that's where my life began. They bought me a few drinks. They bought me more than a few drinks. I walked in at midnight, and I walked out at 4 o'clock that morning, loaded, and as a veteran newsman, you know, because I found something that changed my life. I found alcohol. I found the magic elixir. I had no idea I was an alcoholic in waiting, you know. I had no idea that what it was going to do for me. And as a result of that night, I began to get ready to do things from that point on by having a few drinks. Before I went anywhere, I'd have a few drinks. If I was going to go to a dance, I'd get ready by having a few drinks. You know, if I was going to go out on a date, I had to have a few drinks to get ready. Then I'd have a few more to take her on the date. You know, it became such a comfortable part of my life that there was nothing wrong with it. It was just wonderful. And And so then I began to have a few problems with it here and there, you know, like wrapping up cars, you know, getting into fights, throwing Jimmy Steen into the jukebox, you know, stuff like that, you know. And it's amazing, isn't it, what alcoholics put up with, you know? I mean, it's incredible. And every time I hear speakers from up here share all those things in their story, it amazes me what I put up with, what I went through, and still continue to drink. I worked for this newspaper, to move this along, I worked for this newspaper for 8.5 years. And my alcoholism was apparently the fast-growing kind, you know, because it zipped me right on down into the toilet very quickly, you know. My father, it took him 35 years before he found Alcoholics Anonymous. Me, it took me from 1955 to 1960, 8 years, and I was here. But I had no idea what was happening to me at this point. All I knew was I was a big-shot newspaper reporter, and, man, I had the world by the tail. And so I started, as I say, a police reporter, and then I began to cover general assignments, and then they found that I could write. They brought me in a night rewrite, and then they found I could really write. They brought me on a day rewrite. And then by the time I was 22 years old, I was a byline feature writer for the largest evening newspaper in the world. Now, I say this, and I share this with you, for really only one reason. You know, you, like I, have had so many opportunities in our lives that this disease took away. And that's what happened to me. This disease began to take them away one at a time. Alcoholism does not leave any stone unturned in our lives. It affected every single aspect of my life, every single aspect of my life. God gave me the talent to write. Alcoholism took it away for quite a while. So I say, by the time I was 22, I was a byline feature writer. And that's when Bernadette and I met and got married. She passes over that very, very lightly. Like, it wasn't a serious thing. We eloped and got married. It was a very serious proposal. I remember this Saturday night, we were dating, and I was going from bar to bar to see friends, you know, and she was coming with me. But after about the fourth or fifth bar, she said, "I'll just wait in the car from now on." So. And so I said, "No, I'll take you home." She said, "No, I don't want to go home." I said, "Well, what do you want to do?" She said, "I'd like to stay with you." And it had been so long since anybody said they wanted to stay with me. I said, "All right, let's get married." So that's, you know, I just wanted you to know it was a very serious proposal, you know. And so as I say, just to cover my career, I became a feature writer when I was 22. And by the way, I mean... the opportunities, I still, maybe one of these days I'll write a story about it. But, I mean, I was sent down to Alabama, Birmingham, Alabama, to watch George Wallace bar the doors of the university against blacks. You know? I mean, I covered the last execution in Sing Sing Penitentiary. Watching a man burn is not a pretty thing to do. And I got really drunk after that, you know. The first shot, Sputnik shot up into space, you know. The first man to be operated on and turned into a woman. That was a hell of a story. And I kept looking under his skirt for proof, you know. And but I had these wonderful opportunities. But the alcoholism began to really impact my life. You know, I went from, you know, a weekend drunk to a daily drinker and almost a daily drunk. And I got fired five times from this paper for different things, but they were all alcohol related. First time I got fired was for being drunk on the job. I was sent to cover a five-alarm fire that was going to general alarm at the Brooklyn Navy Yard. And I was in a bar at the time when they reached me, in Monahan's Bar and Grill, and I got a bottle, what was left of a half, about half a bottle, and a six-pack of beer, headed down toward the Navy Yard in Brooklyn, and I was driving along Atlantic Avenue under an elevator train. And I forgot at Bedford Avenue in Brooklyn, went back underground and became a subway. I just kept going straight into a cement stanchion, 80 miles an hour. The motor landed in my lap, busted 6 ribs, fractured my jaw, spit up part of my tongue, lost some teeth, you know, came to in the hospital. Anyway, after about 2 weeks, I went home. I went back to my mommy and daddy's house to recuperate. You know, that's where all alcoholics go, right? We get into trouble, we go back to mommy's house. And my father invited all of my friends to come over, you know, visit me in his house to pay their respects. to an injured warrior. And, you know, alcoholics love to visit the sick and bury the dead as long as there's a bottle around. And, you know, in my dad's house, there would be. And never forget, the bottle was being passed around and everybody was, you know, chug-a-lugging. When it came to me, my dad grabbed the bottle and he said, with that wired-up joy, you shouldn't have any hard stuff. So he handed me a bottle of Christian Brothers Sherry Wine. Now, that's very sweet, you know, but if you drink enough of it, you can get pretty drunk. And it's so sweet, if you drink enough of it, you can get it pretty sick. And if you ever tried to puke through a wired-up jaw, from personal experience, I can tell you that the big pieces come out of your ears, you know? So I swore off Christian Brothers Sherry Wine. I kept getting into trouble on the paper. And by the time I was 24 and a half, roughly 25, I was the obituary editor. Yeah, and that's different than being a feature writer. My city editor kept firing me, rehiring me. Eddie Mahar was a great city editor, and he liked me. He liked me. He was an alcoholic who had stopped on his own because he was going to lose his wife, lose his job, and lose his reputation as being the president of the Catholic Institute of the Press. But he was the angriest man I had ever met in my life. Eddie was so angry all the time. And I often say he's the only man that I knew that could string together 17 profane words and make a perfect English sentence, you know? Yeah, that's how angry he was, you know? So anyway, he kept finding me. And now, as the obituary editor, at that point, I was spending more time in Mucci's than I was in the city room because Frank Mucci would get drunk and forget that instead of buying back every three, he'd buy back every two, sometimes even every one. Sometimes, if he's so drunk, you get the bottle yourself and pour your own. So I spent a lot of time in Mucci's. You know, it was one of my high-class places, you know. Mucci's, Cuckoo's, Tootie's, really high-class places. Tootie's had the only barmaid I knew that had a beard. But she was a nice lady, though. Anyway, I don't even know why I say these things. So anyway, I didn't have time. I was supposed to call up funeral homes in New York and find out what well-known people dropped dead that night, you know, and write their obituaries. So I didn't have time to do that, so I would tear them out of other papers and send them into the composing room. This was the day before computer type, you know. We were printing obituaries of guys that died 2 days ago. And now I was getting letters in my mailbox from the city editor saying, we want fresh obits, you know. What the hell is a fresh obit? You know, the guy's dead. So anyway. So I knew I was going to get fired from that job, so I got a job working for a magazine. Now, I'm laughing about this, but I'm blowing a hell of a career. I mean, this guy, Maha, said he had to love me, and he was steering me right, you know, for the top, and I'm blowing it with my drinking. I'm drinking away things that I loved, and now I get a job working for a weekly magazine. I'm traveling all around the country, interviewing famous people, getting drunk and drunk and drunk in blackouts, turning in bad stories, and I was about to get fired from that job, and then I got a job working for a radio station in New York, WR Radio, writing radio shows. Fantastic opportunity. John Scott loved me. He was the producer over there. But I wasn't showing up enough, so they were about to fire me. And I got a job working for a little PR firm, and that lasted me about 4 or 5 months. And that's when Bernard said I became unemployable. You can imagine what kind of a husband I was. She says I was a good husband. I wasn't a good husband. I wasn't a good father. I was a drunk. Drunks are not good husbands, and they're not good fathers. I thought I loved my wife. I thought I loved my kids. But I loved alcohol more. I did not know I was powerless over alcohol. If you told me that, I would have laughed or got angry. I had no idea about this disease. And so, as Bernadette said, by 1961, I was a very sick man. Of course, she's right. I wasn't coming home very often. And the reason we wound up in my mother-in-law's basement is because she didn't know it, but the bank was about to take away our house in Deer Park. So we had no place else to go. So I phoned up a story. Why don't we just live with your mother for a little while, and we'll take the money we get from this house, and we'll go around, buy a house near your mama. Big lie. Another big lie. End of it. I'd lied and lied and lied. Even if the truth were better, I'd lie. I mean, my sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous always said to me I was a perfectionist in the art of self-deception. This means you're a liar. That's what it means, you know. Anyway, 61. I weighed about 320 pounds. I've never been a lightweight, always been a pretty big fellow, but 320, a bloat. In fact, on 45th Street in New York, I was known as the moon. Hey, look, the moon is out tonight. And I'd waddle in the saloon, you know. Yeah. And I was a walking fruitcake. I mean, I was a really very sick guy and didn't know how sick I was. I had no idea. All I knew is that everything was slipping away, and I didn't know why. I couldn't control it. I tried my best. I mean, even with God, I mean, I kept pleading and pleading, and finally I just feel he didn't want anything more to do with me, and so I departed from God and from church and from all of that stuff, you know? So by 61, I was very sick physically, mentally, and spiritually, and didn't know what was going on. So as Bernard said, I thought I was crazy or going crazy. I came to out of a blackout. You know, we come out of blackouts in some strange places, right? And this, I was in a Third Avenue saloon, sawdust on the floor, spittoons at the bar rail, which for most drunks is simply a shortcut to the men's room. And I was frightened. I was scared to death. Like, I was always afraid inside. And I was afraid these days now to go to sleep, because I was afraid if I died, I was going to go to hell, wake up in hell. So I would now pass out and wake up, or pass out and come to, pass out and come to. So this night in his bar, I was sitting there, and I started thinking, what's going on? I was 27 years old, and everything was going. And I hated to go into that basement, because to get to that basement that I was living in, my mother-in-law's house, you had to pass her dining room. You had to walk in the side door, go down past the dining room. And my mother-in-law was always sitting at the dining room table praying. Now, her mother was a prayer. I mean, she was a prayer. She had always had two stacks of prayer cards, two sets of rosary beads, the New Testament and the Old Testament, and a book, and the Lives of the Saints. That was her paraphernalia for her. And I knew she was praying for me. And I would stand there, drunk as a skunk, and scream at her, stay out of my life, I don't know your prayers, baby. And she would just keep praying and praying and praying and praying and praying. Now, here was a woman that saw what I was doing to her daughter and her grandchildren. She never said a word to me. She was a very spiritual woman whom I came to hate with a passion because she made me feel so damn guilty all the time, you know, without saying a word, you know. But then I came to love her in sobriety more than as much as anybody I've ever loved. Anyway, so now at 61, and I just say, Bernard told you about, you know, a daughter got sick and we brought her to the hospital. And when, in the bar, by the way, when I came to out of the blackout, I realized, I thought I was crazy. Because being crazy to me made sense. It explained why I was doing all these things I was doing and doing them over and over and over again, things I didn't want to do. You know what I'm talking about. The promise we make to ourselves and make to others that we're never going to do this again, never. And I would do it again and again and again. So I was crazy. So that night when we stopped in this Chinese restaurant and she looked at me, Bernadette looked at me across the table, and she said, for God's sakes, Bill, why are you doing this to yourself? I broke down. I started, not the you know, crocodile tears that, you know, we manipulate people with, but I just broke apart. And I said, I think I'm going crazy. And as a result of that, her calling the doctor and all, the following Saturday, I found myself sitting in front of a psychiatrist, Dr. John Brancato. Never will forget him. And I got ready to go see him. You know, if you're going to see a psychiatrist, it's a big deal. So you got to get ready. So I got ready. I stopped at Fred Funk's saloon. I had about 6 or 7 shooters. And so by the time I got there, I was in good shape, you know. And I remember looking in a barroom mirror and saying, you're going to tell this guy the truth because you really need help. And I wanted help. I needed. I knew I was in bad shape. And so, but he had no couch. We were talking with somebody, I think it was Dave at dinner the other night, right, about psychiatrists, and he went to one that had a couch. Mine didn't have a couch, you know. In fact, he sat me in a chair right in front of his desk. So I sat down, laid my belly on his desk. He told me later on I looked like Porky Pig with a hangover, you know, so he was a nice doctor. Anyway, he asked me why I was there, and I told him I thought I was going crazy. And he said, why? I said, I don't know. And I started telling him, you know, some of the things I was doing, you know, waking up in subway trains and having fallen asleep in some kind of a flea bag hotel and on and on. And then he stopped me and he said to me, you drink a lot, don't you? I said, well, what do you mean a lot? I don't drink a lot, you know. Well, he was smelling me. I guess that's why he figured. He said, well, what do you mean by not a lot? Do you drink beer with the boys on weekends? I said, yes. He said, how about, do you drink beer on Mondays, Tuesdays, Wednesdays? Yeah. How about Thursdays and Fridays and Saturdays? I said, yeah. Aside from beer, do you ever drink any vodka? You ever drink any scotch? You drink scotch. You ever drink any rye? I said, I drink rye. Do you ever drink any wine? I remember saying to him, I don't drink any Christian Brothers sherry wine. You know, he got very sick on that once. But what he tried to do was to paint a picture of a guy who was 27 years old who drank every day in the week, anything he had his hands on. And then he said to me, Bill, do you know what an alcoholic is? And I said, yes, I do. He said, well, tell me. And I described the guy sitting on a curb picking lint out of his navel, right? The alcoholic. And he said to me, yeah, but that guy was probably born in a nice place like you, maybe a nicer place like you, and through the use and abuse of alcohol, he wound up on a Bowery. He's in his final stages of his disease. And then he began to talk to me about the disease of alcoholism. And I got the impression that he was insinuating that I was an alcoholic. And I really got teed off. I mean, I'm sitting there thinking, I came to this guy out of the goodness of my heart, you know? And now he's insulting me by calling me an alcoholic. What does this bum think he is, you know? And then it's off and off at the end. He looks at me, what a sweetheart of a guy. And I managed, by the way, I did manage to thank him before he passed away. Because, you know, he died 2 years later. But he looked at me and he said to me, Bill, if you are an alcoholic, I can't help you. He was really a straight guy. And he said, but I know some people who can. And he opened up his Rolodex, wrote down the phone number of the Intergroup Office of Alcoholics Anonymous in Manhattan, New York. And he said to me, if you really want help, go over to see them. They can help you. But no sense coming back to me because it costs $50 a visit. By the way, this is 61. And he says, and if you want to keep on drinking, you're going to need the money. So he was very straight. So I go back to the basement. And I sit on one cot behind the oil burner. Bernard sits on the other cot. And I tell her, you know. And then she gives me this stuff about, well, what's American Airlines going to do for you? So, but I mentioned Alcoholics Anonymous and something to do with drinking. She said, oh, yeah, go. So I went. And I walk into the Intergroup office, and there's this guy, a giant of a man named John, volunteering that day. You know, and he had, never will forget, you know, we remember certain things. He had this brown tweed mohair jacket, sports jacket on, and a handlebar mustache, you know. And he stuck out this hand that had to be the size of a catcher's mitt. And he said, my name is John. I'm an alcoholic. You got a problem with alcohol? I says, no, not me, John. But there's a psychiatrist back in Queens that thinks I do. And he sent me over here for some information. So you want some information? I'll tell you what. I'll take you to a meeting, an AA meeting, and you can get all the information you want. I said, okay, that'd be good. He said, well, how about tonight? I said, well, I can't go tonight, John. I'm busy tonight. Nothing to do but drink. He said, oh, I'll tell you what. And then God, you know, Bernard talks about God, and God is in our lives, and God is always stepped in at the right time, but even when I wasn't ready. And I wasn't ready, but he stepped in, and what happened was John reached into his pocket, and he handed me his card. And he said, anytime you want to go to a meeting, call me up, and I'll take you to a meeting. And I said, thanks, John. And he said, I started to walk out. And I had just happened to glance at the card. And I must tell you, and as Bernard said, I became very friendly with finance companies because by this time I owed 5 finance companies, 3 banks, 2 loan sharks, and my Aunt Jenny. And I was in serious trouble financially. So I looked at the card, and it was John So-and-so, Vice President of Chase Manhattan Bank. I said, I got to get to know this guy, you know. So I walked back to the desk. I said, John, I think I can make it tonight. So that's how God got me to my first AA meeting. But it didn't take. It didn't take. Excuse me. So, because they wanted me to go to meetings in my neighborhood, you know, my home group kind of thing, you know. And I wasn't going to tell them. I didn't want anybody to see me going to AA. God, see me going to AA. I never thought, stopped to think that on Saturday afternoons they'd see me urinating on their hedges. But to see me going to AA, oh, no. I went 3 miles out of my way to Woodhaven Group, stayed around long enough to prove I wasn't an alcoholic, and I did that by comparing myself to whatever you did that I didn't do, that kind of thing. If there's anybody here wasting their time doing that, go out and drink, you know, and then come back when you're really ready. Although if you're here, you're ready. If you're here, you're ready. I mean, nobody comes into an AA meeting instead of going to a movie, you know. You're ready. I come back to the I come back to tell Bernard that after 3 months that I learned something about things. She says, "What'd you learn?" I said, "I learned that if I ever kept drinking the way I was drinking, someday I could have a lot of trouble." And here we are sitting on 2 cots behind the old burner. You know, she said, "What are you going to do?" I said, "I'm just going to drink beer." Right, famous words, and I did till about midnight. Then you got to get the beer down with something, right? So, And then first week of April of 1962, I was sitting on a window ledge of the Margarita Hotel on East 21st Street, ready to jump. There was an air shaft in between buildings, and I crawled out and sat on the ledge. And because my life was over, 28 years old, I believe my wife hated me, my children were afraid of me, I couldn't get a job. I was washed up in my profession. Even in New York, you can get a bad reputation in the media when people check on you. And but for some reason, God gave me another chance. And I came back down and went home and told my wife I was going to leave her for good. She'd be better off without me. You know, all that kind of, you know, sob stuff. And she said to me, and there's a woman I thought hated my guts. That's why Bernard and I are still married after 54 years. She said to me, "Before you leave, do you think you owe me one last favor?" I guess so. She said, "For God's sakes, why don't you give AA another try?" People who love you don't love you, don't say that. People who love you say that. And I did. And they came back that Monday night, April 8th of 1962, and brought me back. And the first thing my sponsor did after the meeting that night, Benny became my sponsor that same night. I had met him the year before. He brought me into the kitchen, filled the sink with hot, soapy water, brought in all the mugs and all the ashtrays and all the spoons. And back in those days, we drank coffee out of mugs. You can't get sober washing styrofoam cups, for God's sakes, you know. And I was the dishwasher. And you know, without exaggerating, you know, I'm not exaggerating when I say this, but when you do something like that, when you stick your hands in that hot, soapy water, you start washing cups, something happens to you inside. Just happens to you inside. Because you don't know it, but you're performing service for somebody else, and it makes you feel good. And it was my first feel-good feeling in Alcoholics Anonymous. And then I got promoted. 3 months later, I became coffee maker. Loved it. You know, guys come in early, you stand around the coffee pot, they tell you it's a good cup of coffee, tastes like iodine, but they tell you that anyway, you know. And I being moved up the ladder, you know. And then Bernard told you, we moved to Nashville, and I got a job as a PR director for a big company down there, and then moved to Cleveland and got a better job. And then in 1968, some guys in Cleveland, in the business world, because I had been about a huge conglomerate in Cleveland, and they had enough confidence in me to finance me to start my own business in New York, a communications business, and I did. And a year later, 1971, through an investment banker, I got to meet three guys who wanted to start an independent motion picture production company. And I joined up with them. Because I wrote radio shows. I always loved the movies, and I loved to write. So I was going to read the scripts and do some polishing and stuff like that, handle promotion and all that. So we became partners, the four of us. Called it Artist Entertainment Complex. And as Bernard had said, we were very active in Alcoholics Anonymous, she was very active in Al-Anon, and we had this large family and a lovely big home which we fixed up, and it was just going fine. So the first movie we made, by the way, if anybody's got my color hair, you might remember it. It was called Kansas City Bomber. Starred Raquel Welch as the roller derby queen. Yeah. And watching Raquel Welch in these black, tight-fitting leather pants skating around the rink was like having a spiritual experience. So I fell in love with the business, you know. So, and then a friend of mine, we had been reporters together. He had been on the Herald Tribune, and I was with the Journal American. And we covered the Knapp Commission, which was an investigation of dirty cops in New York. And the undercover cop there was a guy named Frank Serbico, and they tried to kill him a couple of times, so he fled to Switzerland, and my buddy went over. And Peter got his rights and came back and was writing his story, got a deal with a publisher. And we had lunch one day, and I said, "Look, you know, why don't we get the movie rights from you? We'll buy the movie rights and make a movie." And he said, "Great, if you can do it." So I said, "Well, we're going to try." So we got Dino De Laurentiis to put up the money, and we got Al Pacino to play the role, and we made a movie called Serbico. And that sort of put us on the map. And then one day we're sitting at the four of us are sitting at a meeting in the office, and my friends are drinking their scotches and their ryes, and I'm drinking my Coke. And they got a sheet. Marty had a sheet from Life magazine, one story column about some young guy in Brooklyn that robbed a bank to get his friend a sex change operation. And it wasn't my cup of tea, but it looked like a pretty good idea for a movie. So we made it something called Dog Day Afternoon, and then one day I said to them, "Now it's my turn." By now, Bernadette had introduced me to Lois Wilson. I had met Bill a couple of times at his birthday parties in New York, which were fundraisers for the Intergroup office. Never really got to know him, but just shook his hand and chatted for a few minutes. But it just left such an impression on me. But then when Bernadette met Lois and invited me up to the house, and we became really good friends, and Lois began to transfer her love and confidence in Bernadette to me, I asked her one day if I could have her permission to do a movie about her and Bill and how AA started. And she turned around to Bernadette and said, "Can her husband really write?" So Bernadette assured her. So I got her permission. And so I said to my buddies, my partners, "I want to make a movie about AA," and they laughed. So by this time we were parting company anyway. You know, sometimes you get too successful in that crazy business called movies. So I formed an independent company myself and got Lois's permission. And I spent many, many hours, many, many days, many, many weeks, many, many months with Lois, sharing her life with me and with Bernadette. She shared some of the most intimate moments in her life because I wanted to be able to try to tell her story along with Bill's story and Dr. Bob's story and how all this came together to create Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember she gave me some wonderful, wonderful insights for some of the scenes that I had. And I remember somebody once asked me, was at some kind of a press conference, if Lois answered all the questions that I asked her. And I assured them that she did, but sometimes she answered them in her own way. Like one day I was sitting there talking with her, and we got onto the subject for some reason about how alcoholism affects someone's sex life, you know? She said, "Apparently it didn't affect yours too much, but some people it really does." And I said to her, "Lois, what was it like when Bill would come home really dirty, stinky, smelly, drunk, you know, and crawl in bed and want to make love?" And she looked at me and she smiled and she said, "Ask your wife." So that's how she answered that question. So, by the way, you know, the reason I'm sharing this is because so many wonderful things happen to us in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know? I mean, all of us, we're given so many blessings. And sometimes, and I was one of those guys, sometimes we're like embarrassed to share the good stuff because people might think we're bragging or egotistical or odd. Yeah, well, of course I am, but at the same time, you know, I also have a lot of humility, you know? As a matter of fact, my sponsor says I got so much humility, I'm proud of it, you know? But so, the truth is, this is the truth. This is what happens in Alcoholics Anonymous. This is what happens in sobriety, you know? We're able to fulfill dreams that were only once drunken dreams. And you all know that. And that's why I'm sharing some of the good things in my life with you. Because they happen. They're gifts from my higher power. You know, God gives us things when we're ready to handle them. Because I thought I came to Alcoholics Anonymous to be a better husband, be a better father, be a better worker, be a better provider, all of this kind of stuff. And it took me a while to come to understand that God didn't bring me to Alcoholics Anonymous for any of that stuff. Those are the fringe benefits. He brought me here for only one reason, and he brings each and every one of us here and in Al-Anon for only one reason. Only one reason. I now know it in my heart and soul, and that's to get ready to help someone else, to be a useful tool for him to help someone else. That's it. Simple. It is in my life these days. That's why I'm not, you know, reluctant to share all of this stuff. Whether you want to hear it or not, I'll share it with you. Anyway, so as a result of that, I wrote a movie called My Name is Bill W. Starred James Woods, James Garner, Joe Beth Williams, and you know, won 7 Emmys. Jimmy won a Best Actor Award. It was wonderful, wonderful, wonderful thing. And then I had all of these tapes from Lois, and now years go by, she passes away, and I don't know what to do with them. And one day We moved to South Carolina for, you know, a number of different reasons, some of them medical and so forth. And I'm in my office, and I put a tape in, and out comes Lois's voice. And I felt kind of guilty because Lois gave me so much and I gave her so little. Because in doing the movie, My Name is Bill W., there just wasn't enough time to tell her story. There was time to tell the Bill story and Dr. Bob's story and how AA all came together and all that. I wrote two scenes about Al-Anon, but they cut them out. And because 98, well, yeah, but I didn't cut them out, Enid. They did, you know. She's still got a resentment against me all these years, you know. But it was 98 minutes. You can't, but, you know, Hallmark Hall of Fame. So, but anyway, so Bernie comes running, and hears Lois's voice. He goes running into the office. Oh, that's Lois. I said, that's Lois. Yeah. You got to do something with that. I know I got to do. You got to do something with that. I know, Bernie, I got to do something with that. You know how wives are. Blah, blah, blah. You know, anyway, it didn't take me long. You know, it didn't take me long to know, you know, what God wanted me to do with that. He wanted me to write a book so we can make a movie. And it's that simple. You know, a lot of hard work and stuff over 3.5 years, but that's it. And so, as a result, today we got a movie that'll be coming out in April called When Love Is Not Enough. That's what Lois used to say to me all the time. She said, you know, I always thought, in the beginning in particular, when we got married, that I didn't worry about his drinking because I always knew my love would be enough. You know, I would stop him, you know. But I found out as it got worse that love is not enough. Love is not enough. It's wonderful after we get sober how much the love comes back, like you were talking about, Beverly, you know? It comes back, you know? It comes back. My mother-in-law understood that, and that's how I want to close. I just want to quickly share with you my mother-in-law again, yeah? Mama. She saw all this stuff, oh, never said a word to me, suffered through it all, prayed through it all. I don't think I'd be here today without her prayers. When we were living in Nashville, we moved to Nashville, I was sober just maybe a couple of years. We were having, Walter. And Mama come down to take care of Bernadette and the baby, you know. Mama loved babies. You got 16, you got to love them, right? And so she's got Bernadette tucked away one night and the baby in the bed and the kids all tucked away in bed. And I'm in the den, and I'm starting to do some writing, and Mama comes walking down to go to the dining room to do some praying. And she's got all of her paraphernalia with her, you know, all the stacks of prayer cards and her rosary beads. And she passes by the den, and she looks and she sees me, and she stops and she comes in. And Mama was just a little thing, Mom, maybe 5 foot tall, I don't know. And you love her. She was walking love is what she was. And so she comes in, and she says, am I disturbing you? No, come on in, Mom. And she sits down next to me on the couch, and she puts the stuff in her lap, and she looks up at me, and she says, you know, Bill, she says, all of my life, you know, I read the New Testament and all the miracles that Jesus did. And then I read the book of the saints and all the miracles that the saints performed. And she said, I've often wondered what it would be like to see a real miracle. And then she put her hand on my shoulder, and she said, now I have. And for the first time, I realized that's what this is. If people don't like to hear that, fine. But we are all miracles of our higher power. Thank you for letting me share that.
Oh,